Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Well, the surge in violent crime, of lawlessness and disorder in big blue city America is so pronounced. It's such an obvious problem that two things are happening. One is the D.C. press corps is telling you it's not an obvious problem. And two is even Illinois Republicans recognize it as a problem. And when a group as dense as the sort of superstructure of the Illinois Republican Party sees something for what it is, then you know it's got to be obvious. How obvious is it?
How obvious is it, Dan?
It's so obvious. that you have two GOP candidates for governor already running ads on the topic.
Oh, that's right.
Thank you for setting up my impersonation of Dana Carvey impersonating Johnny Carson. Richard Irvin and Jesse Sullivan, two of the more well-financed candidates in the Republican primary for governor, are both out with ads on the topic of crime in Illinois. Of course, they're mainly talking about Chicago, but as we know, it's not limited to Chicago. Jesse Sullivan touting his experience in Afghanistan. Richard Irvin touting his experience as mayor of Aurora during
the riots.
Why don't we start with the Ken Griffin sponsored candidate, Aurora Mayor Richard Irvin.
A riotous mob, the police outnumbered, but backed up by their mayor. Richard Irvin called in the guard, closed exit ramps, shut down the riots.
Aurora will be ready for you if you come to our community wreaking havoc. We will prosecute you to the fullest extent of the law. We will not put up with this BS and foolishness. This, I guarantee.
They tried to burn his city down. Richard Irvin took it back. Elect Irvin governor. We'll take back our state.
Yeah, taking it back.
It's a perfectly finely crafted ad, and yeah. You could get a sound bite like that from Mayor Lightfoot, too.
Oh, of course.
For the purposes of a 30-second spot. So don't get too wooed by that, because the response I have to that spot, were Richard Irvin courageous enough to come on the show, which I'm sure he's not.
No, he's doing the Joe Biden campaign. He's going to hide. Next week it might happen. With certain reporters, by the way.
A simple question. Mm-hmm. You characterize yourself as an enthusiastic supporter for Black Lives Matter. So you taking our city back from who exactly?
312.
We're going to take Illinois back from who exactly?
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Until I get an answer to the I'm an enthusiastic supporter of Black Lives Matter, a Marxist organization coming from an erstwhile Republican candidate for governor, then I'm really not interested in talking about anything else, because it is such a disqualifying comment, and it has much less to do with race than it does with the underlying Marxist ideology of Black Lives Matter, which includes race. Race is a part of it, but it's bigger than that. Which is why it's disqualifying.
Well, also, too, he was pro-shutdown during, the first round of the pandemic and then the second round, and pro-mask. He didn't send his police officers in to locations if they weren't wearing masks, but he didn't stand up and say, freedom of choice, like Pekow did in Orland Park.
Right, and others.
And
too.
Others,
and others that were not particularly ideological. I mean, Skip Saviano in Elmwood Park is not exactly an ideological conservative. And he took the same position as Pekow did with respect to his businesses. We're not enforcing somebody else's order.
Yep.
It was self-determination for our businesses. I'm not going to be party to putting our businesses out of business and so forth. So, yeah, right. So taking it back from who? You're a Black Lives Matter enthusiast and a COVIDian.
And that was just one night.
Is that what we have now?
Yeah, well, that's a good question.
Jesse Sullivan, he's the
Tom Brady's little brother.
Okay.
He totally looks like Tom Brady.
Yeah, all right.
Oh, I know.
You get it together. Yeah, I know. The ladies are going to swoon for Jesse Sullivan.
Oh, they are.
So I hear.
Yeah, he's the hot topic.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he's so dreamy.
Piece of beefcake there down in central Illinois. So he's back. He's sponsored by Big Tech so far. We've had one interview with him. And, you know, it's the judgment's out, and I'm reserving it because he's a neophyte, so let's see what he does. Well, this is one of the first things he's done. He's released this spot.
Deployed as a civilian intelligence analyst in Afghanistan, I know corrupt war zones torn apart by violence. But this isn't Afghanistan. This is Chicago. Pritzker's leftist agenda is literally killing us, turning parts of Illinois into a war zone. But I've got a plan. Defend our police, not defund them. And take the cuffs off our cops and put them back on criminals. My name is Jesse Sullivan, candidate for governor. Join me. Let's save Illinois.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Yeah, what do you think of that one?
You know, I get 30-second spots. I've written enough where it's tough to get very much in, and you want to convey sort of a feeling from the visual experience, and you want to make sort of one overriding point. And the overriding point there is, you know, Chicago's like Afghanistan, and he's going to do something about it. So you're left with these cliches, defend, don't defund, take the cuffs off our cops, and so forth.
Yeah.
You know, one thing you might consider, though, is rather than just those bromides, like a big idea. And so he actually has a few points on his website if you go there and follow up on this spot and look at it. But, I mean, they're relatively anodyne, and one of them is a bad idea. I've said it every time it's been suggested, usually by Democrat city council members or state legislators or Cook County commissioners, and that is use the National Guard for domestic policing. That's one of the things that he includes in his plan to provide aid to the war zone that is Chicago, right? You know, the National Guard, they're not trained to do domestic policing. It's not a personnel problem. It's a political willpower problem. So, you know, we've heard this, bring in the National Guard. John Fritchie, former Cook County Commissioner, LaShawn Ford from the West Side, other city council members. It's tiresome. It's not real. One of the things you could think about if you're a candidate for governor is, well, golly, what kind of power does the governor have? And maybe I would be focusing on the power my office does have, not to intercede and try to run Chicago or Aurora or anywhere else for the local officials, but to say, you know, there are state powers, and a lot of those powers have to do with the distribution of resources, and we're going to distribute resources consistent with incenting local authorities to provide for the protection of their people if they're not. I mean, focus on what you can do as opposed to sort of the cheap, the feel good, like sound like you're doing something, sound like this is going to be important or this is going to have significant impact. Just focus on, you know, you and your constituents want to live in a place that is lawless. I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think most people like it. So I'll tell you what, I'm going to use the position I have to encourage you to make better public policy choices. And if you don't want to, then there'll be consequences over what I control. But, you know, ultimately, that's what you decide. I just think it's a more sensible approach than sort of the cheapness of some of these bumper sticker slogans and frankly, even policy proposals. So Richard Irvin wants to run on his record, and Jesse Sullivan wants to sort of run on
what?
Well, I mean, I think he's going to have to run on ideas because he just doesn't have much of a record. And, you know, he weaves in the background in Afghanistan and making the obvious Afghanistan-Chicago comparison.
Right.
But, yeah, he's going to have ideas because he doesn't have a record. And, you know, that can cut both ways. And so can a record, as Richard Irvin, I think, is going to find out before all is said and done. One other thing, neither one of them was explicit. Jesse Sullivan came much closer. I mean, just in terms of political positioning, and this is, you know, again, where you have to play the game a little bit, I think. Name names. Lightfoot and Fox are not mentioned in either one of those ads. And, you know, one of your jobs as a candidate or as a party is to connect dots for people. How is the governor connected to the mayor or the Cook County State's attorney? Well, they're connected in material ways. Obviously, an abundance of resources from the state flows to Chicago. And, you know, Illinois and Chicago's destinies are tied together.
Right. Everything that happens in Chicago bleeds through the rest of the state.
So, and Chicago land, right? When we talk about Chicago, we sort of implicitly include the collar counties. So a discussion about that. I mean, you can't unfurl something in depth in a 30-second spot, but if you're going to post plans on your website and so forth, then, you know, detail some level of understanding. That relationship is important. There should be a relationship, but there can't be a relationship if you don't have agreement on the basics, like the provision of protection for your constituents. And we don't have agreement on that with Lightfoot and Fox, and that has to change. And it's going to change because I'm going to use the bully pulpit to say, well, here's what I can do, and here's what you can do, and we can either go to war over your failure to provide for the protection of your constituents, of the residents of Chicago, or we can do it in a way that both Chicago wins and Illinois wins by extension. I think there just needs to be more texturing there. Again, this is, you know, really actually constructively critical at this point because this is their first offerings for both of them. And for the other candidates as well. So I'm not getting all worked up about what's not in there, but I'm just suggesting as you think about this, voters, Republican primary voters, should be pressing candidates to frame these things as the campaign develops, as you see these candidates on the trail, and see who really is demonstrating an understanding and has put in some thought in terms of the approach that they would take, rather than just sort of, you know, I'm for cops and the Democrats are not, and I did this, or I will do that. You know, get beyond just taking a position. Get to, you know, explaining a point of view, of providing a perspective on what you would bring to the job, is my point. Greg and LaGrange, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. I think the thing I'd like to hear more, and I know it doesn't cost a lot of money early on, is Darren Bailey and Gary Rabine and these other guys start coming out with their ads and their ideas. I think one of the worst ideas, it's just so easy to throw the red meat out there and saying the National Guard is one solution to the problem. It's not a solution. It's a horrible solution. It demeans the police department. Your problem is the police department. Your bigger problem is society in Chicago. Let's face it. We have a lot of murders in this city. We have a lot of crime in this city. Let's look back 20 years. We had a lot of murders in this city. We had a lot of crime in this city. We're just becoming anesthetized to it and weakened to it. And we need to start changing that. And that means everything needs to change. Businesses need to change. School boards need to change. Churches need to change. This is a grassroots problem, and somebody that can reach out to that level needs to do so. The mayor from Aurora, he has no standing whatsoever until he starts to address the basic question about why he supported BLM. Because if you look at it, look what happened to Andy Ngo. I think it was at Princeton. They shut him down. Or Dartmouth. I think it was Dartmouth. They shut him down in a speech because of political pressure. That's all related. All that is related in the same undertow of this counterculture that wants to destroy our values and our families and law and order.
All right, thanks for the call, Greg.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Because they got the beat. The campus beat. The campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Dan and Amy, we go to the Ivy League in this installment of Campus Beat, if for no other reason than to encourage you to avoid the Ivy League with your kids.
Yes.
And for your kids to do the same. A legal studies professor there named, at Wharton, I should mention, as I teased, Wharton. So the business school at University of Pennsylvania. Donald Trump, a graduate.
Right, I was just going to say
that. Wharton. I asked Wharton student Nina Strominger is a legal studies professor there. I asked Wharton students what they thought the average American worker makes per year. And 25% of them thought it was over six figures. One of them thought it was $800,000.
The average?
Yeah.
What kind of world do these people live in? Oh, my gosh.
Really not sure what to make of this. Mm-hmm. So... $800,000. That's a bit over the top.
Isn't everybody rich? What?
For a baseline, and by the way, she says the professor that people want to say this is something problematic at Wharton. She argues that people are notoriously bad at making these kind of estimates, and people think the gap between the rich and poor is smaller than it is. So that was sort of her point. I don't think I agree with that. And I also think that her question was sloppy. The average, how much does the average worker in America make? Is it average or mean that you're getting at? Those are two very different things. For example, the average wage in the U.S. last year was like $53,000. The median wage is if you're rounding up, $35,000. Okay. Big difference.
It is a big difference.
And, we should have all learned the difference between average and mean in grade school. I don't think they do that anymore. They're too busy with their race hustling. But
they're at Wharton. I mean, okay.
Well, right. There's actually a response to this from a hedge fund dude that was sort of interesting, although I don't completely agree with him as well. But he sort of rallied to the defense of the students. He made the same point I did about the difference between average and mean. You need to be specific. These are Wharton Business School students. They should have asked for specificity. They probably don't, think in their mind the difference between average and mean. Are we talking about individual? Are we talking about household? These questions weren't asked. They just hazard a guess because the professor says guess, so they throw out a number. So that's both on the professor in terms of shoddy question making and on the students. I think you got a problem on both sides, actually. He rallies to the defense, this hedge fund guy, Aaron Brown at RealClearMarkets.com, rallies to the defense of the students saying, actually, a quarter guessed six figures, and that's so far afield. But is it really? I mean, if you say average wages, $54,000, and then if you include the benefits package, that probably takes it up to close to $70,000. You're still off by a pretty big margin, but it's not as crazy as you think. It's not like they think everybody is rolling in the dough. I think that's a bit too generous to the students, but I do agree with his implicit criticism of the professor. The $800,000, I don't know how you reconcile that.
Wow. Really in touch with the poor.
Well, yeah. I mean, the other thing Brown, though, talks about, and I guess it was posted maybe by the professor that and here we go again, mixing and matching. The median household income for a Wharton student is $195,000.
Wow.
Which is not surprising. So we're talking about median household incomes for Wharton families, and we're talking about average income for a worker. Is that a worker or family? Is it average or it's median? I mean, so, this conflation, maybe a revisiting of sort of stats 101 here would be useful for the Wharton kids and the professors, for that matter. But Aaron Brown, this hedge fund guy, points out a couple of other interesting things, too. Students who do not support themselves, in my experience, have no idea how much their own family earns nor how much money is allocated to taxes, rent, food, other expenses. Yes, but we're talking about Wharton here. And so I don't think that's much of a defense of Wharton, because most of these top business schools, you have to do what before you go to a top business school? You have to work for a couple years in order to get in. You can't go right from undergrad to Kellogg or to UFC, to Booth or to Wharton. So these kids are ostensibly have been out in the real world. Now, maybe they're still being supported by their families, but that's not much of a defense. He also said, Aaron Brown, this hedge fund guy, students are far more open about their sex lives, drug use, and health problems than they are family finances, and far more knowledgeable about that as well. Well, that may be true, but to me, that's another indictment of the students, isn't it? And he goes on to talk about other things, advising students about career choices, you know, the difference between making 40 grand a year in San Francisco or 45 or 40 grand a year in Minneapolis, or if you're a graduate of Wharton, making 120 in San Francisco or 150 in San Francisco versus 120 or 150 in Minneapolis, obviously adjusting for cost of living and right. So on and so forth. So I guess, you know, the takeaway from the Wharton thing, everybody focuses on the students, but particularly the one kid who guessed 800 grand because it's such a, you know, it's so crazy and it just speaks of how thick is your bubble. But I think if you actually think about this a little bit more, which very few people do, especially reporting on this, it's sort of an indictment across the board. And this is one of the best business schools in the country with ostensibly some of the best and brightest future business leaders in the country. Huh. Speaking of the best and brightest, let's fold in Princeton, too, while we're in the Ivy. One of the best universities, you know, by reputation, by status, in the world, in the West. The Princeton University Ballet is a student-run recreational ballet club.
Okay.
They have put forward documents about the ballet as they try to provide stewardship of the Princeton Ballet Club. Here's a document. You actually got two documents. One is sort of writ large. One is specific to the ballet that Rod Dreher over at the American Conservative obtained. Ballet is rooted in white supremacy and perfectionism. We are all entering this space with a mindset that what we see as perfect is a white standard. Unlearning that will be difficult but rewarding. Before we begin detailing our action plan, we want to acknowledge that our leadership and those who comprise this plan are all white. Can we just get to the dancing part?
Yeah, please stop.
Firstly,
yes.
All these black swans came together to produce this document. We would like to add land acknowledgement to our shows in addition to historical context in our programs, as if ballet wasn't difficult enough to watch. We rarely shed light on the problematic history of our art form and want to bring it to the forefront of our performances. We aim to decolonize our practice of ballet, even as ballet remains an imperialist, colonialist, and white supremacist art form. I mean, literally, like, they're flogging themselves like Natalie Portman in Black Swan. They're, like, attacking themselves. We realize our distinct freedoms as a college-run dance group, which is that we do not report back to any sort of board or funding programs that would restrict our choices. In selecting new members and cultivating our style, we want to centralize artistry instead of technique in the hopes of maintaining our core purpose as a ballet company, but doing away with some of the stringent and exclusive standards that pervade the art form. Uh-huh.
I'm not eating M&Ms, and I'm not going to that.
Uh-huh. And they, you know, go on to talk about their dye work, diversity, inclusion, I'm forgetting all my acronyms. Equity. Thank you so much.
I love that word popped up, and now it's never going to go away.
It's
press conference. It doesn't matter, governor. Anyway, equity.
It's the purpose of our existence.
Yeah.
To achieve the unachievable, equality of or equal outcomes. And then there's this other document at Princeton circulating, the Action Plan Student Performing Arts Group Questions. Your EDI, or DI, Diversity, Inclusion, Equity, Circuit Action Plan will serve as a clarifying series of steps and analyses that gives your students Arts Group, a foundation for culture, identity, anti-racist strategy, and a greater accountability structure for DAI. Mm-hmm. Questions you need to ask yourself. What is your individual and group understanding of DAI, anti-racism? Do you feel your group has established healthy practices to foster trust and psychological safety? On a scale of from 1 to 5, how equitable is your group today, anti-racist? How does your group structure support this critical conversation? What are your commitments and actions to foster DAI? What coalitions? So on and so forth. How are you recruiting? Does the recruitment end with membership? How does competition drive your recruitment efforts and so on and so forth? I mean, this questionnaire goes on in perpetuity, and it's basically, you know, half a dozen sections that are just asking the same questions over and over again in different form. You know, basically apologize for being white. You know, the ballet company saying we're a white supremacist organization. We're trying to decolonize ballet. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
And find ways to get more people of color in the ballet so that you can flog yourselves for their enjoyment as well. Sounds like a fun recreational activity to participate in if you're an undergrad at Princeton and you like to dance, or you know, specifically ballet. So Wharton Business School at Penn, Princeton University, I mean, a little, you know, ballet club they've got there. This is what the best and brightest in the most exclusive places are being indoctrinated with. I know you've heard it before on this show, and we've given you innumerable examples, and we're going to continue to, because I don't think it's penetrated enough people deeply enough about the implications of this, both for your kids in terms of what kind of campus experience they're going to have, and also what kind of life they're going to have based on who is going to be in positions of authority in this country in the next generation or two. I mean, you think it's bad now. You think it's oppressive now. You haven't seen anything yet if you don't derail this sort of indoctrination. Steve and Roselle.
Yeah, I didn't know that Rahm Emanuel was steeped in such racism and colonialism by being in the ballet for so long.
It's true. Sarah Lawrence grad. Yeah. Tiny dancer. Thanks for the call, Steve. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the Nassau County judge in New York overturned the state's mask mandate in schools, but then a stay was issued. So that is still pending. There is also something pending in Illinois, a similar legal action, where you had Tom DeVore, an attorney representing some 140-plus school districts, file suit to overturn the same mandate that exists here. We're going to have Tom DeVore on the show tomorrow to give us an update there and what he expects will happen, and then what will transpire after
on
courts
Friday,
weigh
yeah.
in here the end of the week. But
everybody's watching that court case.
CPS is dragging their feet, as I understand it. We'll have to go to our CPS beat reporter, that is Amy Jacobson, on that.
Well, yeah, because I asked Pedro Martinez, the CEO of CPS, you know, if a judge renders a similar decision on Friday, what are you going to do? Because some kids I know in this state are going to take off their masks right away. And this is the plan, Dan.
I will tell you, the people that I listen to are the medical professionals. So I will stop mandating masks once Dr. Awadi says stop mandating masks. Trust me,
man.
I wish we could not have masks in classrooms, but until it's safe, we're going to continue our mask mandate.
Okay, be your own man. I mean, honestly, he's so green and young, and
be your own man. You know, Pedro loved you in the with the two seam fastball. back in the day with the Bow Sox. But when it comes to how this works here, Dr. Arwadi isn't the law.
No, exactly.
I will continue to enforce as long as Dr. Arwadi. I'm sorry, if a court intercedes and says you do not have the authority to impose a mask mandate at the state and or local level, then you shall comply with the court order, not with what Dr. Arwadi says. Do you understand the difference?
But I know, and I was trying to say that to him, and then they all walked out. I'm like, you're going to defy a judge's order? Okay. And also, too, guess how many kids right now are home today that are healthy, perfectly healthy? Take a guess. The highest ever we've ever had. 19,414 students. And we were told as parents that you could test to stay. So if you test to, you know, if somebody in your classroom has it, you could, if you test negative, you can stay in school. And they lied to us. They're not doing that, Dan.
We warned ahead of time that we were going to be much more conservative in quarantine children. We're doing that. It pains me.
Then don't do it.
As cases started declining with all these other
safety. Blah, 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 blah.
I wouldn't call it conservative. I would call it draconian,
heavy-handed,
authoritarian, autocratic. Jen Psaki, the Raggedy Ann lookalike, who is the White House spokesman, she was asked by Steve Ducey, you know, that son of a bitch.
Wasn't using that word yesterday. I was calling him a son of a biscuit.
Uh-huh. Well,
but
that's the difference between me and Biden and you.
Okay.
He's a stupid son of a bitch, and you just got to say it straight away. Stupid son of a bitch, Steve Ducey asking Jen Psaki, who's in the best position to decide on this matter of mask wearing?
You on schools in Virginia, seven districts representing 350,000 students are suing the state. They're hoping to get a strict mask mandate for students that has been rolled back by the new governor, reinstated. So who does the president think knows best for students, school board members or parents?
Well, the president believes that public health officials have the best guidance on what we can all do to protect ourselves, including teachers, administrators, and students.
Uh-huh. Oh, my God.
So public health officials, again, top of the pyramid. So now you know where Pedro Martinez gets it. Public health officials are at the top of the pyramid above the rule of law. Is that what I heard? Both of them?
Yeah, I'm so sorry. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are so high and mighty. Now this new found power that they have.
All public health officials or just the public health officials that agree with your political position? That would have been a nice follow-up from that stupid son of a bitch. You know,
I'll take a question from you, SOB. What do you want?
They use public health officials in the same way they talk about masks. It's sort of this generic category to make you believe that there's no difference of opinion or, in the case of masks, difference in efficacy. You know, when they say public health officials, they say our people. When they say masks, they say, do what I say.
Yep.
There's no discussion. There's no debate, and there's no acknowledgement that there are differences of opinion within that community of public health officials, not to mention, you know, that step back. It's just remarkable that they don't get called on it more. Public health officials. We're talking about courts of law. We're talking about a duly elected governor who issued an order. So you want to have a legal fight in a courtroom? Okay, sure. Go ahead. Those school districts in Virginia. Go ahead, those school districts in Illinois. Go ahead, those school districts in New York State. Go ahead. And then when the court enters its order, you know, that's the law.
Right, that's the law. And then what are they going to do? What are they going to come up with? Because I feel like the kids at CPS are going to be masked for life if Dr. Arwadi's in charge, which apparently, and now we know for sure that she is, because Pedro Martinez with his tail between his legs, like, whatever she says. What she says.
Did Dr. Arwadi welcome the deference that Pedro Martinez afforded her, that she is where the buck stops? How did she react?
They walked out.
Well, I mean, she's where the buck stops. She doesn't have to answer questions.
And then she gets them with her driver, and they take her away.
She's not elected. She's just in charge.
Mm-hmm. She is in charge, and she's in charge of this vaccine mandates that we are supposed to, because I know you don't want to talk about districts and regions and bridges, but we went from, you know, 10,000 cases a day. We're now at 2,000. So we're on the other side of the peak. And they told us when we're on the other side of the peak, Dan, that the vaccine mandates will be lifted. Oh, we'll take them away. So why aren't they away? We were here when you and Mayor Lightfoot announced the vaccine mandate. And at that time, you said when we're on the other edge of this peak,
yeah,
then we're going to drop the vaccine mandates so that people can have some medical freedoms and, you know, do things that mm-hmm. we used to be able to do when we were in a free country. So we're clearly on the other side of the peak now. So what measures and metrics have to be in place in order to drop the vaccine mandate?
Yeah, so I talked about this on Facebook in some more detail. So as a reminder, we can, you know, the reason we follow those four main things that we've been sharing is they match up broadly against sort of what the CDC is doing. There's four levels of concern from CDC, level one, level two, level three, level four. We and the rest of the country remain in level four, high risk, still more people getting admitted to the hospital every day with COVID right now. We are coming down, but we are not in a point. Remember, the main reason we do this is to help keep people from getting into the hospital, honest to God. Like, and so my goal, we will not keep this in place indefinitely. As we move, seeing some of that movement across our metrics back toward lower, right, that blue, that's what we want to see. We get.
So she did embrace it. I'm just struck by this because I know people are just listening to what the policy is going to be and these explanations. As we move on, we will not keep these policies in place indefinitely. I'm sorry. Who are you again?
Yeah.
You are a policy advisor. You don't make policy.
You don't.
You provide you provide advice and counsel to the mayor, to the city council. You see, perhaps a little tutorial, doctor. We have an executive branch, and we have a legislative branch, and we have a judicial branch. You're an unelected agency director. You're a manager and a policy advisor. Who are you to say, even if I like the policy, even if I like your policy, who are you to get up there and tell the city of Chicago a policy will or will not stay? It seems to me we miss the predicate. We miss the premises. We never go after the premises. We're just interested in what the declaration will be. No, no, I'm interested in somebody who thinks they're in charge, who's not in charge, Al Haig. And that's unfair to Al Haig, but nonetheless. You're not in charge.
But she, I know. But she even we have a mask mandate in the state of Illinois, okay? But it doesn't matter because she said when cases are 400 or less a day in Illinois.
I don't care what she said.
No, we're going to take away the mask. I'm like, but you're not the governor.
Yeah, I don't care what we're going to do or we're not going to do. Because I'm not even interested in what comes after that until and unless she's reminded of her position. And to the extent that Jelly Belly or Triple Threat want or the city council, those 50 train sales want to get up there and say, we've ceded our statutory and constitutional authority to Allison Arwady. Fine. Say so. Until then, stay in your lane, doctor. You know, something else, too, about this unwillingness to take positions, as they take positions on everything else, these public health officials that operate above the law, as we've come to understand. Tony Fauci was on MSNBC. Of course he was. Friendly audiences only. He was asked about the school in Flint, Michigan, the school district in Flint, Michigan, that has gone remote indefinitely.
So sad. That is the last thing those kids need. Breaks my heart.
The only thing that may be worse is if they're actually in school. But nonetheless, so what's your view on Flint, Michigan? You got a view on everything.
Oh, gosh. What's his
view? He's got a view on what senators say and what they don't say, on topics that are economic policy related. What about Flint, Michigan? Should they be open?
Oh, no.
So when we read headlines like the school system in Flint, Michigan has decided now to go virtual again indefinitely, Does that make sense to you? Given all the tools we do have at our disposal right now, sending school kids home again, you think that's a good idea?
Well, I can't comment on any individual school district because things differ from district to district, and I think that would be unfair.
Oh, it's unfair. Oh. But it's not unfair to comment on states during the lockdowns. It's not unfair to comment on people who are taking a position adverse to your advice and counsel. You don't know what's going on in Flint, Michigan? It's sort of high profile. Been mentioned for the last week. Did you take the time to investigate? Why don't you investigate it, apply your expertise and your measurements, and come back to us and tell us whether Flint, Michigan school district should be open or not? Won't take a position on that, but he's not a political actor. He's a public health official. He's a public health expert. He stays in his lane. No, he doesn't.
No, he doesn't. Remember when he said about Ted Cruz, you should worry about, you know, the January 6th insurrection.
Exactly.
Shut up. That is so out of your lane.
Exactly.
It's not even the same area code.
Exactly. And then he gets on to these shows with MSNBC where he's lauded with the bootlicking of a Stephanie Ruhle and bitches about the ad hominem attacks and the threats his family's receiving and so on and so forth.
God, stop it.
The navel gazing of the public health official who's above the law. Marvin, Burlington, Wisconsin, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, it's really, good morning first, but it's really difficult is how do you believe anything these people say? I mean, more evidence has come out about the Wuhan lab and these bureaucrats knew all along the situation and where it came from. And they just continue to not be truthful. So why would we even want to believe anything they have to say about masks or vaccines anything? I mean, well, you know, it's really, who are you supposed to believe in today's world? And
Chicago's Morning
news
Answer.
Media.
Yeah. Thanks for the call.
Well, and what he's saying, I mean, this vaccine mandate, this is not about safety or getting the numbers down. It's about people getting vaccinated. And she admitted that yesterday, Dr. Awardi. It's unbelievable.
Well,
do you think vaccine mandates are working?
Yes.
Why? What makes
Because we've seen, so a couple things. We've seen a nice uptick actually in those 18 to 29 and 30 to 39. And we collect data actually at the sites that the health department is running.
So that's why they're doing it, because they want everybody to be vaccinated. They don't care about
no kidding
health and safety.
This just in, of course they do. They've talked about endlessly since the vaccines came on the market under emergency use authorization. 100% vaccination and nothing less. Vaccination of 330 million people or bust. That's been from day one. Why would that change now? And plus, it gives the rationale for everything else that they do in terms of mandates and pronouncements and status building and the rest of it. No kidding. What's new about that? All right, let's rock it out. Kid Rock's got a new song.
Okay.
Wear your mask, take your pills. Now a whole generation's mentally ill.
One more.
Facebook, Twitter too, and the mainstream media. You too, 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 boo. Yeah, you.
We the people. Ooh, yeah. We the people.
Dan and Amy, Chicago
Morning. Inflation's up like the minimum.
What Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A few weeks back, I suggested that CPS and really Chicago more generally, it's not a repair mission, it's a rescue mission.
That's right.
You can't repair the hole in the hull if no one on board wants to repair it. So you need a third party to come try and get the people off who want to get off.
But are there enough lifeboats?
Well, they're not, but...
And what song will you be playing when it goes down?
You try and save as many as you can. Yeah, I'm just an idea guy. You need more talented people to do the implementation. And one of them is Jeannie Allen. She is the CEO and founder of Center for Education Reform. And after the latest work stoppage at CPS by the Chicago Teachers Union, her organization put together a bunch of money to distribute to a bunch of private schools in Chicago to get as many kids onto lifeboats as they can. It's called their Chicago Rescue Grant Stop Award for the schools that have received up to $250,000 to cover the tuition costs of additional students they will accept coming out of the Chicago Public Schools. I like it. And as I understand it, they just took this upon themselves. They didn't go bend the knee before Cardinal Supich or ask permission from anybody. They just said, we've got this money. Here's an application if you're a school interested in accessing it for the purposes of taking in more students. We'll cover the tuition costs. You do the education. And let's get some kids prepared for the real world. Love it. Jeannie Allen joins us now. Jeannie, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. Give us a sense of scale here. What kind of money did you put together? How many schools in Chicago are participating? How many kids are being helped?
Sure. Thank you so much. And you know what I love is when you said we didn't ask permission. You know, the P in STOP is permissionless. STOP stands for Sustainable, Transformational, Outstanding, and Permissionless Education. And it is for the new vision and guiding principle behind the work that we're doing at the Center for Education Reform to ensure every child gets a chance at a great education. And so we committed $5 million for the Stop Rescue Fund, and we had almost 100 applications pretty quickly. For people saying everything from I'll take 15 students at my school to I'll take 47 to one correction, we included charter schools or any actually learning institution. If we had had an after school or a boys and girls club that was willing to educate kids all day, as so many did during COVID, we would have supported them too. At the end of the day, we gave just under $5 million, 4.9, to 22 schools who are serving 2,000 students. And it is 12 diocesan schools, which came to us individually, not through the Archdiocese. That's a story for another day. Excuse me. And
I'd like to hear that story.
I want to hear that story. Yeah, yeah. Maybe not. Maybe we have time.
A few charter schools and then some independent private schools like Altus Academy and some others. So they are all outlined with details about what they want to do on the website, which is stopaward.com. And it was just, you know, it was so exciting. And I wrote something yesterday, Dan and Amy, about, you know, Chicago. We have our little newsletter. And I was thinking about Frank Sinatra going, you know, my kind of people, not my kind of people at the mayoral level, not my kind of people at the union level. But boy, these people just came out of the woodwork and said, we'll take them now. Like, we'll make sure we have enough support and resources. Most of them are not, most of them are subsidizing them. They're only asking for a portion of tuition, and they're going to extend them through next year and then work with either the tax credit program to get them covered in perpetuity or other donations. Chicago Field School, Lab School, St. Procopius, St. Patrick, St. Genevieve, just phenomenal. And so every time someone says, oh, those schools, they cream, they don't take anyone, really? No, actually, they're the ones who are always educating when everybody else in the system falls down.
So how do the parents apply, and did you get a lot of Chicago public school students?
So this was totally focused on Chicago public school students, okay. New students. That was the quid pro quo for taking, you know, for asking and for taking the funds. And the parents themselves were calling the schools. So part of, Amy, what got us motivated is when we actually heard from schools on the ground that they were getting overwhelmed by calls. So, for example, Distinctive Schools, the charter school network, that's five schools, had over 250 students that wanted, families who wanted to move their students over to Distinctive, like as soon as these schools shut down in CPS. Same with a lot of the private schools. You know, these are all in very, very low income, deprived, underserved neighborhoods. And Chicago, you know, Southside and Austin and other places. And they had people walking literally across the street from low-income housing saying, is there a place for my kids?
Yeah, I mean, I want to emphasize that point and name some names here because, right, the idea that it's going to these sort of high-end schools and the wealthier parts of the city. No, not really. Chicago Westside Christian School, North Lawndale, St. Anne's Catholic in Pilsen, St. Angela in Austin, Academy of St. Benedict, the African in Inglewood, great people there. I know some of those people. Bob Mazakowski, Chicago Hope Academy on the west side. Bob Mazakowski's a hero. So, I mean, these are people that are sort of already in the business of working in the most difficult neighborhoods and educating anybody who, you know, along with their parents, wants to have a choice. And now you just enhance their ability to do so.
Well, and you made a great point, you know, in your opening about a lifeboat. And look, we'd love to get all 340,000 students to have an option. That option might be their local public school, by the way. You know, a lot of people think just because you're giving people an option that you're saying that they have to go to a private or in some cases a charter. No, it's what works for the student. And what we saw, as you guys well know, over the last 24 months since COVID delivered this blow to our world and most particularly to families and students, is that there is no one size fits all, that education should be tailored to the needs of kids. And everybody needs something different, particularly at such a strange time in our life, but always, right? Everyone's different. And so we want to give people the opportunity. You know, look, Illinois, considering how volatile and challenging the politics are, has done a reasonably good job. They stood up a charter school law, you know, 15 years ago. It's modest. You know, something like 70,000 kids get an option, still a drop in the bucket. There's a tax credit program that I know is helping, again, the neediest of the needy kids get into schools of choice. But there's no reason at the end of the day that anyone, any philanthropist that supported the work to do this should have to put money on the table for these kids to get an option. There's right now, in that, you know, Chicago itself got $1.8 billion in federal relief funds.
Right.
All across the country, there are surplus relief funds. The Superintendents Association across the country just banded with what we affectionately call the blob, the education establishment, just yesterday sent a letter to Congress saying, oh, by the way, we have all these extra funds. Could we have an extension and could we spend them on facilities? Now, here's the irony of this. These children are still not in schools that meet their needs across the country. They're ping-ponging open, shut. Most school systems don't have really rigorous virtual education programs, which, by the way, do exist if you give parents an option. And they're asking for money on facilities as opposed to saying, let's give the money to students and families, fund them to make a decision about what's best for them.
That
so
one
we
point,
need to shine. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that $1.8 billion that CPS got, I mean, that won't even cover the pay hike for the teachers in the 2019 contract. So, you know, that just doesn't go as far as it used to. But, yeah, no, I think your point is loud and clear. I wonder, too, as word is getting out within these school communities, and again, just emphasis, Catholic, Lutheran, Christian, non-denominational, charter, across the board of choices. Are you seeing, you know, demand that exceeds your $5 million downstroke? And is this a program you're looking to build upon?
We're definitely seeing demand that exceeds the downstroke, Dan. We are, I won't say we're sort of one and done, but we wanted to stimulate and incentivize, again, the environment and help these kids first and foremost. It absolutely was a rescue mission for whatever we could offer. And we're really hoping that, the owner of the Cubs might step up to do it. You might get other people saying, hey, let's really give a lifeline to these kids on a permanent basis. So, for whatever it's worth, we're happy we're able to help families. But this really needs to, the concept behind it, that money should follow families, is really the principle. And it's an equity issue, right? It's a social justice issue. This is not a political issue.
Uh-oh. You're using their language against them. That's not nice.
Well, have you gotten any threats from CTU? Because they love to threaten people and ruin their lives.
We've seen it before. I mean, the head of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten, has her bots after us all the time, and they're constantly posting things about how awful we are, and going on our Twitter feed. So we've had that for the last 28 years. So it's nothing new. So if they are, I haven't seen it. It doesn't matter. But honestly, they don't have a leg to stand on. They have stopped working repeatedly. They've had, what, 8 strikes?
Well, 5 times in 10 years, they've had a work stoppage or a strike. And we've been there all 10 years of it. Trust me, we've had to deal with this.
And you know this exactly. And Chicagoans have had to live with it. But the ridiculous part of it is that this doesn't represent the rank and file of most teachers. Mm-hmm. They want to do this, pay the teachers directly, to have the flexibility and freedom to choose where they want to work, allow them to run schools and get out of their way. And guess what? If they want unions to help them, let them choose to have a union. This mandated compulsory union representation is such a 1965 thing. It's extraordinary the public lets it continue to happen. And I hope that after these last stoppages, in particular in your fair city, people will wake up.
So, I mean, did you choose Chicago the way that Mother Teresa chose Calcutta, one of the most challenging mission fields possible? Or,
yeah, I have to say that we're still that the echo of Bill Bennett in 1987 saying it was the worst system in Chicago in the country, which was so true. Former Education Secretary William Bennett, which stung then. And look, things did begin to get a little bit better. There were some little higher standards, higher bar, little challenges for a blip of time a few years ago. But it's been stagnant since that slight rise in achievement. And so what does Chicago have that nobody else seems to have? A lot of close seconds, Philadelphia among them, which is where Janine, our founder of our Stop Award, is from. But Chicago has had uniquely the most continual work stoppages, challenges, and complete disregard for human lives in the public school system. It's just incredible.
And that's the way we like it.
Well, no, it's so bad. People are going to be challenging Stacey Davis Gates and Jesse Sharkey in their upcoming CTU elections because they think they've gotten, are you ready, too political.
Too political.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Crazy. Yeah, it's crazy. So look, I mean, this is the bottom line. These are, at the end of the day, for the most part, a majority of people who think that they are carrying on the great, the labor tradition of years of old. Look, it helped my father's people, Italian immigrants in New York, back in the 30s when labor came to their rescue, when they were being discriminated against. It's helped many, many people over time. It has ceased helping people, particularly in public education. And that's why there was a Supreme Court decision back in June of 2019, the Janus decision that actually originated from Illinois, that said you can't mandate that a teacher pay for dues for an organization they don't want to be part of. That's not spread nearly as much as it should. And if it did, we might have a difference. Out there, a lot of teachers are being told, and I know many of them personally, that if they even try to stop or encourage teachers to stop, that there'll be actions against them. So the teachers unions is fighting to keep alive. It's fighting to keep people controlled, and it's fighting to do something that once was noble and has ceased being long ago.
Yeah, yeah. In Chicago, we still haven't got over Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. We still think it's 1906 for some reason.
Exactly.
Jeannie Allen, CEO and founder of the Center for Education Reform. People, if you're going to continue doing this and the schools that are still participating, maybe they have spots. Where can parents listening get more information about the schools and the opportunities?
Please. So two things I'd say to people listening. First and foremost, stopaward.com or email info@stopaward.com. And we can certainly put people in touch with the schools that may have room or give you other ideas. Stop Award also is now our signature program that encourages providers all across the country. We rewarded the best providers during COVID, had a major competition. We'll be opening up that again. And so if there are other schools and institutions, learning, micro schools, pods the parents are running that want to be part of that, they can also apply. And then just follow along at edreform.com. We have newsletters. We have ways to inform people. We just believe information is power. Parents should have it, and would love to help anybody in Chicago or in Illinois that wants to try to give it to them.
Very good. Jeannie Allen, CEO and founder of Center for Education Reform. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks even more for helping all those kids in Chicago. Appreciate it.
Thanks for highlighting it. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, actor, comedian of sorts, Michael Rapaport. You'd probably see him, recognize him when you see him. He's sort of been a bit actor for a long time.
Okay.
One of the Hollywood types who is very virulently anti-Trump during the Trump administration. Well, he's getting mugged by the reality of New York these days with mayors like de Blasio previously and newly minted DAs like Alvin Bragg. He posted this video to his Instagram page of a dude walking out of a Rite Aid in Manhattan with two full bags of stuff that he didn't pay for.
Why not?
And walking right past a guy wearing a security jacket. Just walking right down the aisle towards Rapaport and the security guy, and just right out the door, and nary a word was said other than this commentary.
Yo, I'm looking at this this dude, this motherfucker. Yo, that... This dude is, I can't believe I'm seeing this. This motherfucker, yo, this fucking guy just filled his two bags up with everything in Rite Aid right here on 80th and 1st Avenue. He's walking down the street like is Gucci. Look at me in my face like what's good. I was watching him the whole time. My man just went Christmas shopping in January. He had the condoms, the shampoo.
Yeah, welcome to the party there, Mike. Lance Morrow, a cultural critic, author we've had on the show many times, writing the Wall Street Journal this week about Minnesota, recalling an August 1973 cover story for Time magazine that praised Minnesota is the state that works. The cover photo showing Governor Wendell Anderson dressed in a plaid flannel shirt, grinning and holding up a northern pike he just caught in one of those 10,000 lakes there in Minnesota. The story from Newsweek 1973, from Time 1973. It's a state where a residual American secret still seems to operate. Some of the nation's more agreeable qualities are evident there. Courtesy and fairness, honesty, a capacity for innovation, hard work, intellectual adventure, and responsibility. Minnesotans are remarkably civil. Their crime rate is the third lowest in the nation. 50 years later, writes Morrow, he received an email from an old friend who lives in Minneapolis. The email began, "Another report from the hinterland. The people of Minneapolis now share online updates of carjackings and other crimes. It would be difficult to exaggerate the extent of violent crime throughout the city. Everyone knows someone who's a victim. This will be a huge issue in this year's elections. And Morrow writes, I mean, there's a multitude of variables, but the lack of public safety is at the top of the list. He writes about prosecutors in Democrat-ruled cities across the country that began to refuse to prosecute minority criminals, almost no matter their crime. See no evil, prosecute no evil. An age of magical thinking persuades itself to embrace many inversions of the truth, one of them being the idea that the criminal is the victim. The left, now dominant, will pay the price. Fantasies of retaliation will play vividly in voters' minds when they go to vote in November, just how vividly the Democrat Party and President Biden will discover. He writes, the difference between my 1973 story and the news reports of 2022 amounts to the difference between Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. Tom gives you the boyish, innocent, sunshot rendering of Hannibal, Missouri in the middle of the 19th century. Huck's story is a version of America that includes poverty, murder, alcoholism, child abuse, race prejudice, blood feud, and imbecility. Minneapolis today looks a little more like Huck Finn, the Huck Finn version, although without Huck's humor or his rascal charm. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined again by Chris Arnotti, who is a writer and photojournalist covering addiction and poverty in America. We've had him on before when this book came out, and I highly recommend it again, the book Dignity, Seeking Respect in Back Row America, and his formulation you may be familiar with from our show or other places that have profiled his work, sort of front row versus back row America, which he'll explain again, I'm sure. Chris, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
So you wrote this piece towards the end of last year at your, I think it's your Substack or another Substack.
Yeah, my Substack.
Your Substack. And, you know, about sort of where Biden and the Democrat Party stood. And you sort of come to the same conclusion Lance Morrow does, but you had other reasons at the time. And among the reasons you cited was not crime. And I wonder if that was just an oversight, or if you don't think the sort of the Rappaport journalism there at the Rite Aid or the data now in terms of the spike in violent crime in big cities, not just big cities, but particularly big cities around the country over the last 2 years, if that doesn't play into what happens in November as well.
Oh, I think it does. But I'm kind of looking more at national elections, and I think, you know, crime is very localized. And, you know, what I'm trying to get at is, you know, when I think like a global ways, you know, crime is very localized. And one of the most frustrating things about the recent discussion around it is often the people who are most unconcerned about crime or certainly want to change policy on crime, you know, such as the defund police types, are people who don't live in neighborhoods where crime is currently spiking. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's another issue. But I would say on the national election side, to me, the just biggest issue right now is COVID. I mean, it's just it touches everybody. Crime, you know, crime's bad. But it's localized and it doesn't touch everybody. You can, you know, you can live your year and not have to run into someone at the right unless you're, you know, first and 80th who's doing that.
Oh, and so, by the way, that Rite Aid's closing next week because of things like this. Because they can't afford it. They can't keep up.
But the
other thing is a lot of where the crime is happening is high Democratic strongholds that are unlikely to, you know, necessarily, you know, where Biden won by 30 to 40 margin. It's just really not going to help. You know, if he wins by 20 instead of 40, it's not going to really change things.
No,
but I will say that, like, to me, the biggest issue is entirely crime adds to the whole. My whole point was Biden was elected to return things to normal, and things aren't normal. And crime certainly adds to that sense of abnormalcy. But for me, the real issue is, you know, COVID. I mean, COVID has just completely made it touches everything. COVID policy has touched everybody, and particularly it's touched people in the back row or the people who aren't elites.
Well,
in a negative way.
I want to get to COVID, but just one more point on crime, and then I'll let you opine on COVID, because of course I agree with the premise of what you're saying. But the whole back row, front row America thing, which I like that formulation, it seems to me that, as you say, crime doesn't touch everybody, but it disproportionately touches back row America. And it may not turn New York or Chicago into bastions of conservatism, but it may, and this is the point, one of the points you made in your piece about enthusiasm, it may keep a lot of coalition partners or people that are part of the coalitions that Democrats need in order to be successful in congressional races and statewide races for Senate and governor and other. It may keep them home.
Where it's going to really, and you're already seeing it, where it's really going to change is the GOP, conservatives finally have a chance with Latino voters. And the crime is one of the big issues there because it's happening in their neighborhoods. They generally are socially more conservative than what I think a lot of people give them, you know, a lot of the narrative about them is. They believe in family, faith, and flag. The flag might, you know, their F-150 might have a Mexican and American flag on the back rather than just a, an American flag or an Irish flag. But, you know, they're very similar, and they don't want crime in their neighborhood. And so I think there it's going to have an impact. It could have impacts in a lot of the places around Bakersfield, around East L.A. and places like that, and where there's high Latino presence. And the districts themselves are not like Biden plus 60 or whatever they are. It's all these, gerrymandered away. But, yeah, so I think it can have an impact.
Well, where does inflation fit in with all of this? Because that touches everyone, regardless.
I guess if I had to rank them, my number one is COVID, two is inflation, and three is crime. And, you know, they're all big issues, and they're all hurting Biden and the Democrats. So I really can't see how, it's really setting up for a really atrocious election for the Democrats in 2022. And even, unless stuff dramatically changes in 24, Biden has proven to be, and then fourth, I'd put his incompetence down there. His incompetence is partly why the other three are there. It's not good for the Democrats. And there's really... And in some ways, there's not much they can do about it at this point. These are all things that are kind of viral phenomenons. And once they're out of the bag, you can't really put them back. Literally, the COVID is literally a viral phenomenon. I'm not sure why Biden said he could solve it. It was a dumb promise.
Right. Until he said that it's not going to be solved by the federal government, which, would then sort of violates his promise. But inflation, there's not a lot that they're interested to do, much less really can do, even if they pivoted. There probably are some things they could do with respect to COVID, and particularly COVID and schools, that would perhaps provide, less animus directed their way than currently. So there's some things they could do with respect to COVID policy, COVID response.
I agree with you. They're in a hard place because they listen way too much to their zero COVID policy. The wine moms, the very front row people who basically when COVID hit bought a third home and went there and lived there and got delivery from Uber and delivery from Amazon and other places and took Ubers only if they insisted that their driver be basically in a bubble suit. They're people who basically have completely removed themselves from society and they can. And they're dictating a lot of the Democratic policy towards COVID. So if he tries to shift towards what is the more normy view of COVID, which is, hey, man, can we just get back to living? We've gotten our shots. We've done what we've done and told. And we just want our kids to be able to, be kids again. If they do that, if he moves that, which is the position I think is politically the most, positive position, he gets yelled at on Twitter by people who are 3% or 4% or 5% of the population who happen to be very loud and have a lot of power within the Democratic Party. So it's I agree that he can do things. I don't think it's possible politically for him to do it. If he had some if he was really if he was a true leader, he would. But he seems to be kind of confused.
I think from our previous conversations and your writings, I think, you're sort of a center left guy. And I wonder where you find yourself after Trump and Biden. Are you one of these people now who says I'm politically homeless, or how do you, where are you amidst the last 5 years now?
Yeah, I mean, I have no political home. I mean, I will probably, I write a lot about people who don't vote, and I know it's politically incorrect to say you don't vote. I may not vote because, in honor of the people who are so mad about the whole system, they just like, what's the point, man? I really would like to see the Republicans lose their chamber of commerce wing and actually really lean into some of the things that Trump either accidentally or intentionally leaned into, which is, putting America first economically and really thinking about looking at his supporters and seeing that it wasn't just, a bunch of yahoos. It was a pretty multiracial group, and there's a lot that the working class Hispanics had in common with the working class whites, and focus on finding a coalition there.
Were you encouraged when Kevin McCarthy said that he was essentially going to de-link House Republicans from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce? Because I don't know if he will, but I was happy that somebody actually said it in a position of leadership, and I agree with that too.
Yeah, I mean, one of the more noxious influences on the Republican Party is in your city, is the University of Chicago Economics Department, they've basically been able to win a lot of the arguments. The donor class or the front row Republicans are very different from their base, and that kind of battle was why Trump won. That battle has taken place in some ways, and the Chamber of Commerce got a jeb in his exclamation point, kind of got kicked out of the party. It's not clear that they've given up, though. That the party's completely gotten rid of their kind of like globalist, can't find a war they don't want to fight, can't find a job they can't chip away to another country, wing of the party. And so if that kind of economic wing of the party were to leave, I think there would be a lot more encouraged about the Republicans.
Do you think if Trump ran against Biden in 2024, he would win?
Yeah, so I think it's going to be, I'll piss off the Trump supporters and say that I think he would probably have the least chance of beating Biden. I think at this point, almost any Republican, other than like Jeb, would beat Biden. And I think there's a certain fatigue that would come from the Biden Trump election, but it would just kind of make people kind of feel like they did when they thought about the idea of, Clinton versus Jeb, which is, come on, not this again. But I do think that at this moment, Trump would easily beat Biden. We got 4 years, 3 years between now and then. But I do think Trump is probably one of the weakest candidates to beat Biden, given all the baggage of the past years.
Since you spend so much time traveling around the country and talking to, quote unquote, back row American types. I mean, I agree with your assessment that, a lot of regular people don't take voting as sacrosanct, something that they're compelled to do the way that the front row Americans do. But I wonder if there's another dynamic at play that you're seeing at all with back row Americans losing faith in institutions, whether they believe in government, whether they previously believed in government or were skeptical of government, because there's both camps. And if you see, like in the not too distant future, some sort of manifestation of a real revolt from back row Americans, or is it going to be just more fatalism that overtakes people who think that the system isn't going to work for me and I have no ability to change it, so I just throw up my hands?
I pivot between the two. Some days I think, the fatalism will win, and some days I think the revolt will win. I mean, the thing is like, there's this massive distrust in institutions that I'm kind of like channel, and I'm trying to get people to understand, and to the point where people don't care if they vote or not. Who cares? Like, it doesn't change my life, so why? And the massive faith and massive loss of faith in institutions. I mean, COVID was like, an anvil that broke the camel's back. I mean, that just crushed what remaining faith there was in institutions, as did the 2020 election. it wasn't hard to see that every institution was trying to push Biden to be president, every institution that existed. It wasn't hard to see that every institution was really confused and wrong on COVID. And so, you know, people have a great capacity to, I think most normal people, as most of the, you know, a lot of listeners know from their family members, don't really pay a lot of attention to what's going on in the world, and they shouldn't have to. You know, that's not what living's about, not worrying about what bill is going through Congress. But, you know, they also have common sense. So when they see something that's absurd, you know, it gets them enough angry to you know, and the absurdity of a lot of the COVID policy of the last 2 years and the injustice of it. The fact that, you know, people who were sitting, you know, in their country homes, ordering Amazon, working on their laptop, were, you know, telling them that they have to go to their job, but they can't, you know, go to barbecues. The whole absurdity around the protests, saying that now you can go out and protest.
Right. Just a flick of a switch.
All those things really just broke the public trust to a degree that I think, you know, it could either go into a complete fatalism or it can go into a complete revolt. But it's going to go in one of those two directions because people just have no, you know, the expert class, you know, the front row who scolds you and tells you what you should do. I mean, they got no credibility anymore. And you know, a lack of credibility with your institutions is can cause a lot of things, bad things, and, you know, sometimes good things going forward.
He is Chris Arnotti, writer and photographer, photojournalist, covering addiction and poverty in America. Again, his book, Dignity, Seeking Respect in Back Row America. Chris, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Most excellent chart by Mark Perry, University of Michigan, economics professor and the publisher of the Carpe Diem blog. He graphed price changes from January 20 to the end of last year. January 2000, okay. January 2000 to the end of 2021 last year. And since everybody's talking about inflation, this is perhaps a bit of a teachable moment. Overall inflation during that 21-year period is about 65.5%. Average hourly wages, a little above that, about mid-80s over the course of 21 years. So outpaced inflation by a bit. The more expensive, those things that have outpaced inflation during that 21-year period, what? Food and beverages by a little bit, just a little bit. Housing by a little bit, not much, less than 10%. Child care and nursery school.
Oh, I bet that's insane.
100% inflation over that period. Medical care services, 125% inflation. So 2x the overall inflation rate. College textbooks, 150%. College tuition and fees, about 175%. Hospital services, about 215%. All those things have gotten, you know, exponentially more expensive and outpaced inflation by a factor of 2 to 3 over that 21-year period. The things that got more affordable?
Anything?
Less than zero inflation, actually deflation.
Oh, what?
Clothing.
Oh.
Cell phone services, computer software, toys, TVs are 90% less over that 21-year period. When you had 65.5% inflation. Massive difference. So on the more expensive basket, who's the price setter? Who's the major consumer and the price setter? Hospital services, college tuition and fees, college textbooks, medical care services, child and nursery school. Government. When it comes to those that have gotten more affordable over that 21-year period, clothing, cell phone services, computer software, toys, TVs, who's the price setter? The private market. people exchanging goods and services freely, more or less freely. So government price setter, things are going to get more expensive. The market, people interacting with one another freely as the price setter, things are going to get less expensive. Better for consumer, worse for consumer. Do you get it? That needs to be part of the simple Republican message on inflation and, by extension, government intervention in the economy in the run-up to November, as far as I'm concerned. Let's see how far Steve Moore is concerned. Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, economist, Trumponomics author, joins us now. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, good morning, guys. And by the way, I think officially now, if I heard your weather forecast correctly, the inflation rate in the United States is higher than the temperature of Chicago.
Hey,
Yes.
Yes, it is.
It's in the positive territory. Yeah.
It's minus 36 here, Mr. Moore. Don't you miss living here with the wind chill factor?
Oh, my God. Well, I love those cold, you know, it's just it's a refreshing, you know, frigid breeze.
It's crisp.
No, it's deadly. It's crisp.
Exactly.
Your nose hairs stick
and
together.
And by the way, I just don't want to hear any more of this global war. It's climate change, right? It's climate change, of course. Look, you make a good point, Dan, and I've been making this point for a decade, that if you look at the industries, you're precisely right, and Mark Perry is great. I love his stuff. It's so clear that it's healthcare, and it is it's healthcare, and it's the what's going on with respect to education. And what's really interesting about that chart, because I saw that as well, is that the, correct me if I'm wrong, but the cost of like kindergarten and childcare is not rising nearly as fast as like the overall education budget. Now, why
being led by higher ed because it's subsidized with student loans.
Exactly. So here's my point. What does Biden want to do? He wants the government to take over the child care. And child care is just babysitting, right? They want the government to take over babysitting, and they want to take over the kindergarten industry, which has been pretty much, you know, non-subsidized. And he says that's going to make it more affordable, right? That's his argument. Hey, we're going to get the government involved and then we're going to get it affordable. No, they're not. No, they're not. If the government gets involved in the child care industry in kindergarten, it's going to be more expensive. We know that because that's what's happened with K-12. I mean, for first grade through 12. And that's what's happened with college tuitions. When the government subsidizes something, it actually gets more expensive and less efficient. So this is maddening when Biden says it's going to be less expensive to get child care. Another point I want to make about those statistics. You talk about, look at the industries that are just dramatically falling in price. It's basically the technology industry. Now, what does Washington think? They're monopolists. Google, it's a monopoly. All these computer companies, they're monopolies. We got to stop them. Stop them. A monopoly is something that's supposed to raise prices, but these are the industries. I just looked at the data. Virtually every one of these companies that Washington wants to say is a monopoly is a company that is reducing prices. And I want to refer your listeners, because you've got the smartest listeners in the entire city, to a great book by the guy, and I know you're familiar with this book, Dan. Bert Folsom wrote a great book many years ago called The Myth of the Robber Baron.
Yeah.
And it is a great book because the people like Henry Ford and Carnegie and J.D. Rockefeller, they built this country. They built this country. And the left, they're horrible people. They raped and, you know, pillaged the consumers. No, they didn't. Every one of those industries that were supposedly run by robber barons, guess what? Happened to the prices in those industries, Dan.
Right. They dropped competitive environments versus the state. Yeah,
How dare J.D. Rockefeller reduce the price of energy? How dare Henry Ford produce those automobiles? Why is there among academics this kind of the idea that people build industries are somehow villains? I just don't get it.
Now, I want you to know, since our last conversation, I did find milk. There is milk on the shelves.
Oh, yeah.
But I saw you on Fox yesterday. I think it was yesterday. Or the day before, you were talking about that. Oh, I had to pay about $5.
Yeah, okay. But it beats getting it, you know. Not having it at all, you know. I mean, so this is happening since I, you know, remarked on your show and others about that incident I had. I can't tell you how many people call. Yeah, we're having the same problem in Minnesota. We're having the same problem in Florida. We're having the same all over the country. People are complaining about this, and it is. No, look, I want to make one other quick point, if I may. talk about price, areas where prices are rising right now. Energy prices are rising. Energy prices, you know, home heating price. You're going to pay a lot this winter for your home heating. You're going to pay a lot to fill up your tank. We're now at $86 a barrel for oil. Why is that happening? I'm going to give you one explanation. We're producing less oil in the United States, and this is only enabling. Every time we produce less oil and gas in the United States, who do you think, Dan, Amy, is the biggest winner in the whole world?
OPEC.
Putin.
And Russia.
Putin, yeah.
Yeah, Putin. We are enabling him. We're providing him the dollars to attack and invade Ukraine. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen.
So something else, though, on this grocery store shelves business. Yeah. Muriel Bowser, she's the mayor of Washington, D.C., in case you hadn't heard.
I'm very familiar with her.
her emergency management department issued this public service announcement. If you're hitting the grocery store to prepare for winter weather, please just buy what you need and leave some for others. You may have noticed some empty shelves in some stores due to national supply chain issues, but there's no need to buy more than you normally would. She's essentially calling for voluntary rationing. Maybe we need to stop talking, just saying national supply chain issues, the left trying to sort of cover their tracks. It's the reason that you're seeing empty store shelves and your calls for voluntary rationing is socialism.
Yeah, and what's so ironic about that is what happens when people fear a shortage, what is the first thing they do? They run out and buy as much of the stuff as they possibly get their hands on. That's why we're at an energy, you know, that's why gas prices went up so rapidly in the late 70s. Remember that? Because what was happening is every time they were three-quarters, well, they just made sure they filled up their tank. And so you had much, much more demand for, you know, gasoline because people were afraid of running out of it. So I think Muriel Bowser, as soon as people hear that, oh my God, we got to go out and buy cereal. We got to buy milk. We got to stock the shelves with the stuff at home so we don't run out of it. And, you know, it's just let the private free enterprise system work. You are so right. I mean, the miracle of our free enterprise system is we have all these incredible goods and services. You got companies like Amazon during normal times, they'll deliver anything you want, you know, one or two days, I'll put it right at your doorstep. I mean, it's the magic of the market, and only government could screw this up.
All right. Well, so everything's on the supply chains, though? I mean, is that why the shelves are empty and you can't even get a can of cat food anywhere? Just socialism.
I think
there's a little bit of both.
Well, why were the supply chains disrupted? Because of government intervention.
A big part of it is the labor shortage. You know, yesterday I went out to a couple of stores. I need to get some hardware stuff, and the hardware store was closed. And you know what the sign said on the hardware store?
What?
Door? Sorry, we have to close today because of staffing problems.
Yeah.
I mean, we cannot get people to work in this country because Uncle Sam is subsidizing people not to work. It's that
socialism.
Simple.
You know,
Casey Mulligan at the University of Chicago has done the best work on this, that we keep paying people more and more money not to work because, you know, we want to make sure nobody's, you know, facing trouble. Look, we want a safety net, but we don't have a safety net right now. We have a hammock. I mean, it's a hammock. And it is so, I think you're going to see this more and more. Sorry, we're closed. We don't have the people to staff the store. We don't have you get the ships that come in on the cargo ships. There's nobody to unload the cargo ships at the docks, and then there's nobody at the docks to put the stuff on the trucks. There's nobody to drive the trucks to the warehouses. There's nobody at the warehouses to distribute the stuff. I mean, and then you get to the grocery store, they don't have the people to stock the shelves. It's just, why do we pay people not to work? Economics is so simple. If you make work pay, people will work. If you make welfare pay, you're going to put more people on welfare. And that's exactly what we're doing today.
So you mentioned when we were talking about inflation that you know, Bidenomics and the principle of Bidenomics, that would be Biden, still pushing for Build Back Better. There's still talk about overtures to Manchin. And so since you're on top of this and you and your troika there, you, Kudlow and Laffer, were focused on stopping it. So you're monitoring it. Where does that stand? Is there any possibility that there is life, that there's any renewed life to it?
Yeah, it's a good question. So and there's always, you know, these are politicians, and politicians love to cut deals. So, you know, as we're saying right now, Build Back Better is not dead until January 20 of 2000. 2023 when we swear in a new Congress, and Nancy Pelosi's gone and Chuckie Schumer is the minority leader of the Senate. That's when it will be officially dead. But, you know, Schumer is, you know, we talk about how stupid Biden has been. Schumer has even been dumber. What he's been doing is going on the warpath, attacking Manchin and Sinema. And that's only made, you know, Manchin and Sinema more angry. I mean, my friends who work on the Capitol Hill, my sources say Manchin doesn't even want to talk to the White House right now. He's so pissed off at them.
Okay, good.
So he's only leaving, you know, their strategy of attack. And I was in Arizona last week. There are protesters every day in front of Sinema's office, you know, 50 to 100 of these radical left-wing, you know, progressives, and they're shouting obscenities at her, blah, blah, blah. Well, that doesn't – I'd pay him to do that, because that's only leading these two senators right into our arms. So I think right now I feel pretty confident that Build Back Better is dead. And no, passing Build Back Better and borrowing $5 trillion more money is not going to make inflation go away.
And launching new entitlements. Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, the new book, pick it up, Govzilla, the new Steve Moore book, Govzilla. Yeah. Steve, thanks
right.
as always.
Stay warm, guys. Do you have cocoa in the studio there?
Yeah, Dan loves a hot cup of cocoa with marshmallows in it, too. Yeah.
Absolutely.
There you go. I love it.
All right, thanks, Stephen Moore. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day. Then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We went from the Biden press conference last week where a minor incursion may not draw much of a response from the U.S. to Secretary of State Tony Blinken saying, no, if one of the 125,000 troops that Putin has amassed on Ukraine's eastern border crosses into Ukraine, there will be a response. And then a lot of loose talk about severe sanctions and what and without a lot of definition about what exactly those sanctions would be. Biden asked again about said sanctions and said the following.
I made it clear to early on to President Putin that if he were to move into Ukraine, that there'd be severe consequences, including significant economic sanctions, as well as I'd feel obliged to beef up our presence, NATO's presence in on the Eastern Front, Poland, Romania, et cetera. And but I see, I was watching one of you on television pointing out the fact that, and I think you got it right, whoever it was, I'm embarrassed, I don't remember who, saying that this is all Putin. I don't think even his people know for certain what he's going to do.
Would you ever see yourself personally sanctioning him if he did invade Ukraine?
Yes.
You would?
I would see that.
I know who he wasn't watching, that stupid son of a bitch, Peter Ducey.
And he made that comment. It was so goofy. He was in his friend's boutique in Washington, D.C., in front of a Ruth Bader Ginsburg sweatshirt and some purse with a whale on it. It's not really showing strength. It looked weak, and he sounded weak.
Well, he needed to get a new Ruth Bader Ginsburg sweatshirt.
It was so embarrassing.
Walking around town. Now, here's the concern I have.
Yes.
These 8,500 troops that were scrambling and we may deploy to protect the Baltic states, Poland, Romania, et cetera.
Estonia.
You know. The question is, have we vetted these countries, including Ukraine, if we were to provide any military support to Ukraine? Do we know if those countries share our values?
I saw your tweet.
Do we know if they will enforce diversity the way the U.S. military enforces diversity? Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about, because I'm so want the left to live its values in every aspect of life and policy, as they say. This was the message to celebrate LGBTQ month last year from the United States Army.
June is LGBT Pride Month, recognizing lesbian, gay,
bisexual, and transgender Americans. We observe LGBT Pride Month to mark the progress we've made in embracing a society of equality. But we must stay vigilant and continue to call upon our fellow citizens to eliminate prejudice and embrace the celebration of diversity within our nation. The Army relies on the diverse backgrounds, perspectives, and expertise of all members of our total force. It is only with this variety that we are able to address the complex challenges of the world. As we continue to advance the cause of equality for our force, our Army grows stronger. We sustain that strength by promoting and enforcing an open, diverse, and inclusive culture.
Enforcing diversity. Diversity doesn't need an enforcer, but okay, those are the values. So I just don't want American troops facilitating the patriarchy overseas, you know, being forced to throw in with people that are promoting white supremacy. I mean, these are the real priorities for the left and for the Biden administration, as I understand them. So I'm a bit concerned. Maybe our next guest can allay my concern. She is KT McFarland, former First Deputy National Security Advisor, President Trump, and author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. KT, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
When you put it the way you just put it, we just sound like such a laughingstock. No wonder Vladimir Putin's walking all over us.
Indeed.
No wonder the Chinese are licking their chops for Taiwan. But when you put it all together like that, it's really pretty scary.
These crippling sanctions that keep being referenced, and Biden's openness because he was asked to personally sanctioning Vlad Putin, and I guess trying to get to the billions of dollars he's stolen over the years. That do anything?
No, it's a joke. I mean, Putin isn't even going to shrug. You know, sanctioning Putin, what does that mean? He can't come to America? Putin's got billions, maybe even a trillion, salted away all over the world. He doesn't really care about coming to New York. As far as sending troops, well, okay, 8,000, but they're going to NATO. NATO's already got troops there. I think what Biden is basically signaling, although he's not saying it, is that Ukraine is a done deal. Putin has all the options he wants, everything from, just a minor destabilization of the country to a coup that he could launch with and then install a pro-Russian leader so Russia controls Ukraine's policies, to an armed invasion. And there's not a darn thing that Biden is going to do or can do about it. There's a lot he should do about it, but he won't do any of the stuff that it really matters. And why? It's because of energy. It's because of Germany. Germany, which you need to have any kind of economic, military, political, whatever solution in Europe, isn't going to stand up against the Russians because they depend on Russian oil and natural gas to run their economy. No German political leader, right, left, or center, is going to challenge Russia. So it's, the question I have is, how far does this go? And where does Putin stop? Is he like Hitler? Is he going to just keep going? And what can we do about it? I think there's one single blow we could do that would change the entire dynamic, which is to go back to American energy independence and encourage American exports of oil and natural gas and have Europe, especially Germany, buy American liquefied natural gas. It's cheap, it's abundant, it's reliable, and not be enthralled to the Russian energy exports. But I don't think President Biden's going to do that.
No. Do you think it was an overreach or a knee-jerk reaction to have diplomats and their family members get out of U.S. embassies?
I could have called it either way, Amy. On one hand, they don't want to repeat what happened in Afghanistan, where they stayed way too long, where they left Americans, American embassy personnel and civilian personnel and military personnel, because they didn't want to sort of make it look bad for the Afghan government's prospects. So this time around, they're going to do just the opposite. They're going to pull the rug out early. I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for the Ukrainian government. It's one of the most corrupt countries in the world. If the Ukrainians, however, if they want to fight to defend themselves, I think we give them what they need to fight by themselves. And do they ultimately prevail in any kind of military conflict with the Russians? No, but it will at least bring the price of conquering Ukraine much higher for the Russians to have to pay.
Holman Jenkins in the Wall Street Journal wrote, the cards have been dealt. The relationship between Putin and the Western powers will become more militarized. NATO will be reinvigorated. Mr. Putin will get what he's after, an excuse to attack the last vestiges of domestic criticism in opposition to his surrealistically corrupt rule. But whether this will really work for him at this point is a big question. Will this reinvigorate NATO, given what you were just describing as the problem with Germany?
You know, I read that column, and I usually agree with a lot of what Holman Jenkins says, but in this I completely disagree. I think what Putin is showing is that NATO is extremely weak and is extremely fractured, and I don't see NATO getting together again for its purpose of standing up against the former Soviet Union, now Greater Russia. I don't see it unless we somehow figure out a way that European energy comes from someplace other than Russian pipelines.
And so then this worst-case scenario, if Putin were to stage a coup or launch a formal military invasion and topple Zelensky and his regime in Kyiv, then now you have a NATO problem because you have NATO countries that would be in Putin's sights, and you have this, you know, all-for-one, one-for-all commitment by NATO countries to protect places like the Baltics.
You know, and that's what the worry is that if Putin has whetted his appetite with Ukraine, that it doesn't stop there, that then he's emboldened and then starts going after, as you're right, NATO countries, and then we have a legal obligation to come to their aid. And the place he would go first would be the Baltics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, or the Balkans, towards Crimea. I'm less concerned about that. I think it's a definite possibility. I'm much more concerned with the response that China's going to have to this, not what Putin's going to have to his own successes. I think the Chinese are just sitting on the sidelines watching the movie, eating their popcorn, trying to figure out, well, if Putin gets away with Ukraine, can we grab Taiwan? The Americans are so distracted and they're so divided and they're led by such a weak, incompetent leader who is far more concerned with the woke military than he is with a war-fighting military, that maybe the Chinese make their move. And that makes a big difference to us. Why? Because Taiwan is the country by which you control the South China Sea, the world's most important maritime trade route, and also Taiwan is where all the microprocessors and chips that power modern society. 97% of the world's supply comes from Taiwan. If that becomes in the hands of China, you know, talk about supply chain shortages, you're never going to see a car again.
Is there any concern you think Putin has with the probability of success in Ukraine? We talked to your friend Jim Carafano earlier in the week from Heritage Foundation, and you know, he said, look, you know, the Ukrainians are going to fight, so this is not a fait accompli that he would invade and he would quickly assume control of that country.
I agree. I think that of all the options that I said, from sort of pocketing what he's got now to a coup to an invasion, I think Putin takes the middle ground. I think he forces a coup in Kyiv, and I think the pro-Russian leaders will take over, and I think he leaves troops. Russian troops will remain in part of Ukraine, eastern Ukraine. So what does that do for Putin? Well, it gives him nominal control over Ukraine. It gives him access to Ukrainian resources, which are very significant. And it prevents Ukraine from moving to the West, getting Western investment, or most importantly, becoming part of NATO. I think Putin gets all the stuff he wants without having troops going across the border, which can become kind of risky. It'll be a prolonged fight. And then, you know, maybe he gets other countries in Europe to get a little more nervous. I think Putin gets what he wants by taking that middle ground. It doesn't do him any good to have tanks rolling down the front, the grand boulevards of the capital of Ukraine.
And at this point, this is completely in Putin's hands because we've let it get this far. So it's not like even if we took the attack that the Biden administration took the tack you suggested in terms of moving rapidly towards energy independence policies again. I mean, that's not going to happen quickly enough. So we're in sort of a wait and see what Putin does mode, no matter what's done.
I think that's a good assessment, Dan. I mean, Ukraine's a done deal. I mean, Putin has maneuvered this perfectly, and we've screwed it up perfectly, so that I think Ukraine is no longer going to be an option to be a part of NATO or a member of the West. What I'm worried about is what comes next. And the policy I'm talking about, you know, it can't turn on a dime, but it could turn within a year. You have to remember, a year ago, the price of energy was really low. The United States was a net exporter. We were exporting liquefied natural gas to Europe. Our inflation levels were low. The Russians were broke because with low energy prices, Russia wasn't making anything on its exports. So I think that, you know, it went from really terrific to bad in a year. I think it can go from bad to really terrific in a year, but you have to start now.
Does Putin have any respect at all for President Biden?
No.
Never has?
Maybe. But I think Putin saw him in the summer when they had their summit meeting. You know, Putin and Biden met, and I think Putin took a look and said, okay, I've known Biden for years. He seems very diminished. He's not standing up to me, even though Russian hackers are going in and wreaking havoc in American companies and corporations. And Biden has just given me the green light to make Europe even more dependent on Russian energy by agreeing to the Nord Stream 2. I think that's, if you go back and look at the calendar, when did Putin start making his moves? After he met with Biden. That's when he started reinforcing troops on the border. That's when he issued a manifesto saying Ukraine is historically part of Russia, and so we have every right to it. And then after Afghanistan and our shambolic withdrawal from Afghanistan, I think Putin said, okay, this is my time. I've been waiting 30 years to recreate greater Russia, and I'm going to start now.
She is KT McFarland, former First Deputy National Security Advisor to President Trump, author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. KT, thanks as always.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you, Amy.
Thank you, and she joined us on our Turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, Dr. Robert Malone, virologist and immunologist, had this to say over the weekend at that Stop the Mandates rally in Washington, D.C.
If there is risk, there must be choice. This is the fundamental bedrock truth of modern bioethics. All medical procedures, vaccines, and drugs have risks. All of us have the right to understand these risks and to decide for ourselves whether we willingly accept those risks. Right. To deny this is to deny human dignity.
But how far does that choice go? DJ Ferguson is a 31-year-old father of two who has a hereditary heart condition. He needs a heart transplant.
Yeah.
But Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital, which is the teaching hospital at Harvard, that's where our friend Professor Martin Kulldorff teaches, has removed DJ Ferguson from the heart transplant list because he refuses to get vaccinated.
Oh, please.
And being vaccinated is a condition of being on the list and receiving a heart. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Should the National Transplant Network be allowed to make being vaccinated a condition of receiving an organ transplant the way they do with respect to, say, things like cigarette smoking or alcohol intake?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, if you're obese, why, you know, you're putting a lot of extra pressure on your heart. Maybe you should lose weight first before they put you on the transplant list. Or maybe you should stop smoking first and drinking your face off before they put you on the transplant list.
Well, they do have those restrictions.
Okay.
The hospital has a ban on lifestyle choices like smoking and alcohol. And so the question is not if, because they do have that.
Right, okay.
The question is, should COVID vaccine be one of those conditions? And to your point, what else should be a condition that isn't a condition if we're going to set sort of a standard of choice when it comes to accessing a life-saving organ transplant? This isn't the first case.
Yeah, we did another story, right?
Okay. There's been a few over the last couple of years. You won't be surprised. In October of last year, a Colorado woman, Leilani Lutali, was taken off the transplant list at the University of Colorado Health Hospital because she and her prospective kidney donor hadn't gotten the COVID vaccine. The pair were placed on a list for those who are non-compliant by not receiving the COVID vaccine. She is a born-again Christian, Lutali, the woman in need of a kidney, and she refused to get inoculated because of the use of fetal stem cells in the development of the vaccines, some of them.
I mean, this guy, he's young. I know you said it, but he's 31 years old and father of two.
An Ohio man named Mike Gannon, who was vaccinated against COVID, was denied a kidney transplant last October as well because his donor hadn't received her shot. So this is on both sides. So now if I'm a match and I want to donate a kidney, should I be allowed to donate a kidney? Should these hospital systems, should the transplant network take organ donations from those who haven't been vaccinated? I'm an organ donor. So if I got in a crash and was killed, you know.
Well, that's a good point. Would they take your organs?
You can harvest my organs, but I guess nobody wants them because I'm not vaccinated. All right. I guess I'll take them with me.
And the recipients don't have a choice? I mean, my God, what happened to freedom of choice once again and medical freedoms? Because if I needed a kidney and you got in a car accident, you could give me one. I would say, well, I don't care if he's not vaccinated. Give me the organ.
Right, but then you would have to do it outside of the protocols that are in place by the transplant network and what they will sanction. So I mean,
this,
you know, there's
barbaric.
Right. It's a bioethical question, largely, not really like a constitutional one. You don't have a right to an organ transplant. But you want to have faith in the system as it's currently set up, because that's how you get organ donations to those who are in need of organs. And so is this going to be another institution in which people lose faith and go, I mean, you know, basically what, black market for transplants? I don't know what DJ Ferguson's going to do, but his dad spoke to the local news there and basically said that he's demonstrated he's willing to go to the brink of death because he doesn't believe in the vaccine, and getting vaccinated is not something he wants to do.
Is natural immunity included in this? I'm just curious. Like, if you get COVID, is that considered?
I don't know, but I don't believe so, because where has that been included other
than
recently?
Right, you're right. I mean, it makes so much sense. Why would anybody do it?
Recently, the NCAA actually adopted that posture, but I haven't seen that adopted in these circumstances, particularly with respect to healthcare. Right. Something else too, at this stage where his family is saying that he's got this hereditary heart condition, his lungs fill up with blood.
And so they're
saying he's too weak to be transported to another hospital or outside that hospital. So I guess a question too for the medical professionals would be, what kind of risk, when we're talking about the incidents, rare, but it's happened enough to, again, have the FDA mandate warning labels on the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. And he's a young guy, and he seems to be in relatively good shape other than this hereditary heart condition. He's not obese or anything from the pictures. So what kind of risk does getting the vaccine with somebody in his condition pose?
Oh, that's right.
You know, the risks go in every direction, not just one.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Deborah in Arlington Heights.
Good morning, guys. So let's just play this out. Are you going to deny cancer treatments for a lung cancer patient that is a smoker? Are you going to deny treatment for people that are reckless and sleeping around and contract or pass along AIDS? And as far as having the choice to take a therapeutic or treatment, there are risks associated with that. My dad had cancer, and he did traditional treatments, and then they offered him some experimental drugs. He took a few of them, and then he turned down one, and then, unfortunately, he passed away. But he made the choice, and there were risks associated with that. And there's risks with every drug. Look at the commercials on TV with, like, the, you know, the disclaimer of all the things that, that can happen when you take these drugs.
Thanks for the call, Deborah. And again, I don't know that there's a legal issue here. It's more of a bioethical issue and whether you think that this is a fair thing for the transplant bosses to mandate at this hospital or more generally.
It's just another overreach. And again, you're losing your medical freedoms every day.
Vince in Crystal Lake.
It's another case of doctors wearing black capes and scientists wearing black capes. They're evil. We should take ourselves off the donor list. And my dad had a heart transplant, and I put myself on a donor list just because they gave my dad another 20 years of life. And now I want to take myself off the donor list.
Well,
thanks for the call, Vince. Suzanne, Highland Park.
Hi, thanks for having me again. So, unfortunately, on Monday night, our city council, well, let me backtrack. Our beautiful city of Highland Park was founded in 1869, and I think the end date will probably be 2022. With the rate we're going, our public servants on Monday night elected 5-2 to extend our vaccine mandate, which solely targets restaurants. And we're truly heartbroken. We had a group of seven dining out last night, and we went up to Highwood, where you can dine and party like it's 2019. Uh-huh. It's just pathetic. Our city council is just, there's that old saying, go woke, go broke. And our restaurants are empty. They're struggling. You know, I don't know if there's an end in sight for us, frankly. And you know, it's interesting. We're the only place in Illinois, Highland Park, without our own health department that requires proof of vaccination. And I just want to know why. I really want to know what's actually behind it, because the city has absolutely no data on COVID transmission in restaurants whatsoever. And they've been frank about that. You know, our mayor... We call her Fancy Nancy, but she's also known as Rotten Rottering amongst the business community. She said that, you know, in essence, when asked by the media, she's quoted as saying, "Will you take off your mask? It's not safe in a restaurant." That's her data. You know, at this point, it's, you know, what do we do? Do we fight or do we just go get a U-Haul and hightail it out of here?
The latter.
I'd love to know your thoughts.
The latter. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Suzanne. Appreciate it. Diane, who is a candidate for state senate.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, Dan. So
is this great the open mic Wednesday?
Apparently.
Okay. Hi, Diane.
All right.
Good morning. Good morning.
On this topic of the heart transplant, Diane?
Well, I totally think it's not fair, especially... It does. It takes away our medical freedoms, just like all the other freedoms that we're losing day by day. I totally agree that it is not a fair thing. The risk, you know, like you said earlier, they go all ways, but there still should be a decision, you know, with the receivers. I truly believe that.
All right, Diane, and since you're running for office, that means you're public, so you want to tell us your full name and where you're running?
Sure, I'd love to, Dan. My name is Diane M. Harris, and I'm the Republican candidate for state senate. I'm in the 43rd district. We're out in the south suburbs, Joliet, Romeoville, Bolingbrook, and Shanahan and Jackson Township. And we haven't really gotten stuck with a lot of the mandates that we see in Cook County, but I'm sure they're coming. I'm sure they're coming. But our focus, my focus, tax cuts. We got to keep our people here in Illinois. We got to do that. They're moving away, and we want to keep them here.
Thanks for the call, Diane. Appreciate it. Good luck. Ken Plainfield. Hey, Ken.
Hello. Hey, I'm sorry. I'm out in Nebraska. I lost signal there a little. This kind of harkens back to when Obama said that there would be no death list with his health care plan. sure seems like, you know, they're using this as an excuse not to give people medical treatment, which they said would never happen. Well,
thanks, Ken. Tom, Blue Island.
Hey, good morning, Dan, Amy. This is the perfect example of what Dennis Prager refers to as the difference between a leftist and a liberal. You are going to do what they say, even if at the point of a gun, which for this guy, I guess it is the point of a gun. He's either going to do what they say or he's going to die of his heart disease. A big difference there.
Thanks for the call, Tom. A text from 312. Donors who are ready to donate a kidney should say they will not donate any kidneys to patients in that hospital. So, yeah, is this going to go to Boston, Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital? Well, then I'm not interested. I don't know if you have that kind of influence as a donor because of the nature of, you know, keeping these things blind unless there's some, I think, mutual consent that they won't be. But I don't know. But, I mean, maybe something like that to publicly rebuke the hospital. Lee and Hammond.
Yeah, hi, guys. You know, these doctors took a Hippocratic oath. Why can't he not be sued in civil court for damages by not honoring that oath they took? Also, the same thing goes along with people like Kim Fox, who took an oath to the Constitution and doesn't want to do her job. I think these people should all be sued in civil court. You might not have any recourse in the government, of course, but you should civilly, I would think.
Yeah,
somebody
not really.
Somebody texted into our text line. If people do gender reassignment procedures, do they have to be vaccinated?
Good question.
Yeah, I don't know.
Good question. Yeah,
when yours is coming up, let us know, Dan.
I'll let you know, Daniel, as I get to that decision point. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.